This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات لأبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news. U.S. voices concern about Iran's new space launch after Tehran put three research satellites into orbit. The Russian and U.S. presidents exchange warnings during a phone call amid escalating tensions over Ukraine. Also in the headlines, thousands of people flee fast-moving wildfires in the U.S. state of Colorado as flames burn hundreds of homes. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, the US says it's concerned about Iran's new space launch, arguing that the launch would help the country's missile program. Washington says the technology used in the space launch vehicles is similar to those used in ballistic missiles. It also says Iran's space launches violate the UN Security Council resolution that endorsed the 2015 Iranian deal. Tehran rejects that. It says its missile program is an issue separate from the 2015 accord and is meant for defense purposes. On Thursday, Iran said it had successfully sent three research payloads into space. The country carried out the launch using a domestically made satellite carrier rocket. Iran said the payload reached an altitude of 470 kilometers. Alexander Zardigan is a professor and senior geopolitical policy advisor and joins us now. What do you make of Washington's concerns? I mean, Iran says its space technology is non-military in nature and in no way a violation of international law, especially the resolution 2231, the one that endorsed the nuclear deal, which Tehran says the West interprets unfairly.
Washington's concerns are legitimate. These things have dual usages. They're interchangeable. There is the letter of the JCPOA. There's the spirit of the JCPOA. I'm afraid Washington and her European counterparts have not exactly been acting accordingly to the, at least the, well, both the letter and the spirit of. But these are negotiation tactics. We are hearing from our colleagues in Vienna that at least Mr. Amin Abdullahian was optimistic. They were sending some positive signals out there that there could be close to reaching some kind of a positive gesture or a new understanding of talking about things that they were not talking about before. And so obviously the timing of this is crucial because they're sending a message. The Iranians are trying to say that we are negotiating from a point of strength. Washington, of course, has been addicted to sanctions. So they've been doing that. That's been their modus operandi for the past God knows how. Fifth Fleet is right there in Bahrain in the Persian Gulf. But as one of our colleagues stated recently, and I'm shifting the emphasis here to Israel. Israel actually has an undeclared nuclear program and uses chemical weapons on Palestinians, but wants the world to think that Iran and Syria, for example, are a threat to the region. They keep insisting that Iran is weeks away from a bomb, but they cannot point to a single IAEA report or inspector proving such an outrageous claim. So how would their media survive without such nonsense to peddle?
Just a minute. We just got a minute left. So despite all that, and Iran, we can say it hasn't deviated from its path. Despite all the sanctions within 1 minute, and Iran managing to advance its legitimate space program, just like every other country in the world can do so, is that a sign of failure on the part of the West and the United States in particular? And, you know, on a radar, where does this failure rank?
The idea is to muddy the water, Ressam. That's all this is about, for the purpose of the global viewer consumption. The specialists on all sides, the governments of the world, are extremely well informed. They know better. This is a psychological warfare for the minds and hearts of the people around the world to demonize Iran, to petrify everybody of Iran. And we got a new commemoration coming up in a few days, the assassination of General Soleimani. So they're trying to portray Iran in a negative image. And like I said, every single IAEA report and inspection has confirmed that Iran did stay within its legitimate lines and it did not violate its commitments in any shape or form. But that doesn't matter as long as you brainwash the global audience to think Iran is the big bad devil around the corner.
Okay, Alexander, thank you very much indeed. Alexander Azadegan there, professor and senior geopolitical policy advisor, joining us live out of Irvine. Moving on, Iran's lead delegate to the Vienna talks says there's been relatively good progress in negotiations aimed at restoring the 2015 deal or the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Ali Bagheri Kani says the talks have been focused on the removal of U.S. sanctions from Vienna. Hermolezki reports.
Iran's lead delegate to the Vienna talks, Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Kani, says there's been relatively good progress over the past few days in the negotiations aimed at restoring the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA.
The main focus of the negotiations was sanctions removal. We had several meetings with the EU coordinator and the three European signatories, both on verification and guarantees.
Iran says it will go back to its nuclear commitments only after it verifies the full removal of US sanctions. Tehran has also demanded guarantees that the U.S. will not withdraw from the JCPOA again or impose sanctions that violate the deal. A European source close to the negotiations says all participants agree that verification and assurances have to be reflected in the final document, but that there are still questions on how that is possible. So are these issues going to create major obstacles in the way of a final agreement?
Yes, it's a major problem because these European diplomats know quite well how verification can take place. It's not something strange. If the Iranians cannot use the banking system because behind the scenes the Americans are threatening banks, then that's a violation of the JCPOA.
Russia's lead delegate Mikhail Olyanov said he believed an agreement could be achieved in the first half of February, adding that although the discussions were difficult, there was steady progress.
General impression, business-like atmosphere, positive trends, recognized by everybody, by all participants. We need to be patient, persistent in our efforts, and we will overcome all the problems.
Informal consultations are set to continue within the framework of the Vienna talks. The eighth round will resume after a three-day break for the New Year holidays on Monday. Homolesky, Vienna.
Elsewhere, Russia warns the United States that any further sanctions against Moscow would threaten their bilateral ties. Speaking on the phone, Russian President Vladimir Putin tells his American counterpart Joe Biden that introducing more bans would be a colossal mistake. Biden, for his part, warns Russia of a decisive response in case Moscow invades Ukraine. The 50-minute-long call is the second time the two leaders spoke directly to each other in just over 3 weeks. The West accuses Moscow of planning to attack Ukraine. Moscow denies the accusation, arguing that its military buildup along its border is a means of protection against NATO's eastward expansion. Officials from the two countries will hold the security talks over the issue in January. Political commentator William Jones says the U.S. desire to remain the single rule maker in the world explains its attitude towards Russia.
They're still in the mode of really slicing up Russia and preventing it from becoming what it has become, in the process of becoming a great power. The United States has the view, based really on this Anglo-American doctrine, that we have to make the rules of the road, and that other countries, be it China, be it Russia, especially those that don't have this Anglo-American twist, are not the ones who are going to make the rules. This is the old geopolitical doctrines of Karl Haushofer and Mackinder, and these guys are being followed by the United States. The fact that Putin took the initiative to make this call, I think, is also a significant sign of the danger, because I think he was coming to a point, in spite of the fact that there are some talks that are going to be going on in January with regard to all these issues, that he felt that the U.S. was moving so forcefully in the direction of the red line that cannot be overstepped without a military conflict.
Wildfires batter the U.S. state of Colorado, prompting authorities to issue evacuation orders for thousands of people. Several people are injured by the blaze. The fire has burnt over 1,000 acres of land in Boulder County so far. The inferno has also destroyed hundreds of homes in the towns of Superior and Louisville. The U.S. National Weather Service says the wind-driven wildfires is moving fast in the area, creating what it called life-threatening situations there. Tens of thousands of people are ordered to leave their homes. This is while thick smoke from wildfires is threatening Superior and the adjacent city of Louisville. 2021 was an eventful year for the U.S. and Canada. This report takes a closer look at some of the major occurrences that made the headlines in the two biggest countries in the Western Hemisphere.
The United States in 2021.
Chaos broke out very early in 2021 in the United States. Less than a week into the new year, the world was shocked by footage showing thousands of Americans besieging and storming the Capitol building in the heart of Washington, D.C. The reason? They wanted to stop the certification of Joe Biden's victory in the presidential election. Many called it an insurrection. Rarely has the world witnessed, with such clarity, the inherent division in the U.S. political system. What may previously have been a crack in the country's democracy now turned into a wide chasm. On January 13th, a week after the riots, Donald Trump became the first sitting U.S. president to be impeached twice. The House of Representatives began the trial of the controversial figure after he adamantly refused to concede election defeat and incited his fan to march on the Capitol and, quote, stop the steal. However, in yet another sign of the failure of the political duopoly, the Republican-held Senate did not find Trump guilty. just like the first impeachment proceeding against him on charges of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. On January 20th, Biden took office. The veteran Democrat, while on the campaign trail, had tried his best to demonize the incumbent leader and distance himself from his policies. By taking his place at the Oval Office, Biden towed Trump's line on multiple fronts. The Biden administration obediently followed its predecessor's maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Despite numerous pledges, it refused to stop supporting Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen. Biden even blatantly backtracked on his promise to change the U.S. approach towards migrants. People trying to cross into the U.S. faced even more hardship, and those who could get through suffered severe abuse. But that's not all. Getting COVID-19 under control was another pledge that Biden had made. But after almost a year in office, the U.S. remains on top in terms of both infections and death rates. In late December, COVID fatalities reached more than 800,000, but many Americans remained reluctant to get vaccinated as they do not trust their government. During the current administration, rampant gun violence was a major issue for many Americans. Moreover, little has been done to stop global warming, even though the US rejoined the Paris Climate Accord, which Trump had quit. 2021 has not been a good year for civil rights either. Racial equality remains a distant dream for African Americans, despite a long jail term given to Derek Chauvin, a white officer who had violently killed a black man in the previous year. In September, bipartisan negotiations over a police reform bill collapsed. For now, it seems that minorities will still have to live in fear of police brutality.
Canada in 2021.
The United States' northern neighbor, Canada, also experienced a chaotic 2021. In May and June, authorities found nearly 1,200 bodies of Indigenous children buried in unmarked mass graves. The grim discovery refreshed the historical plight of the First Nation Canadians. The children of these communities were forcibly separated from their families during the 19th and 20th centuries and taken to infamous residential church schools where many of them suffered abuse and torture and many others went missing. The scandal rocked Canada's self-proclaimed image of human rights defender. A cultural genocide was what an investigative commission concluded, saying thousands had died and many were subjected to physical and sexual abuse at church-run schools in Canada. In 2021, Canada also saw continued protests calling for justice for thousands of missing or murdered Indigenous women. According to the Native Women's Association of Canada, Indigenous women are 3 times more likely to experience violence during the course of their life than their non-Native counterparts. The damning figure is a clear sign of the deep-rooted colonialism worsened by state inaction. The country also experienced an unprecedented heat wave in the past year, which led to the death of hundreds of people. Wildfires burned for months throughout much of Canada, making it the 3rd worst wildfire season on record. Flooding was another natural disaster that prompted authorities in the Canadian Pacific Coast province of British Columbia to declare a state of emergency in November.
In Sudan, tens of thousands of anti-coup protesters brave a security lockdown, taking to the streets across the country. Security forces have clashed with the protesters, fatally shooting at least 4 of them. Medics say at least 3 protesters were killed in the city of Omdurman. Security forces also fired tear gas and stun grenades to disperse protesters in the capital Khartoum and the city of Bahri. Protesters were calling for full civilian rule without any military involvement. They chanted slogans against the military chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, who led the coup on October 25. Burhan's forces detained Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok for weeks, but later reinstated him. Anti-coup protests have nevertheless continued. Nearly 50 people have been killed by security forces since the military takeover. Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
In the limelight.
Wartime savagery requires that its perpetrators are told that their actions are acceptable, maybe heroic, and must not cease, says Peter Moss Ryder in an article titled, "The U.S. Military is a Machine of Impunity." Stay tuned for more. How does America react when it kills civilians? Recently, we learned that the U.S. military decided that nobody will be held responsible for the August 29th drone attack in Kabul, Afghanistan, that killed 10 members of an Afghan family, including 7 children. After an internal review, Secretary of War Lloyd Austin chose to take no action, not even a wrist slap for a single intelligence analyst, drone operator, mission commander, or general. Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby bizarrely said, "We acknowledge that there were procedural breakdowns, that it doesn't necessarily indicate that an individual or individuals have to be held to account." There has been quite a lot of savagery adjacent news to absorb this month. The New York Times just published a two-part series by Azmat Khan based on military documents, revealing that U.S. bombings since 2014 have consistently killed civilians, but that the Pentagon has done almost nothing to discern how many were harmed or what went wrong and might be corrected. As Khan noted, it was a system that seemed to function almost by design to not only mask the true toll of American airstrikes, but also legitimize their expanded use. Savagery consists of more than the act of killing. It also involves a system of impunity that makes clear to the perpetrators that what they are doing is acceptable, necessary, maybe even heroic, and must not cease. To this end, the United States has developed a machinery of impunity that is arguably the most advanced in the world, implicating not only a broad swath of military personnel, but also the entirety of American society. Impunity tends to begin at the top. No American general has been disciplined for overseeing the catastrophic wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, nor for lying to Congress about these disasters. The opposite has occurred. Stars have usually been added to their shoulders, and when they retire from the military, they tend to march into well-paid positions as board members in the weapons industry or elsewhere, even though they're not strapped for resources thanks to pensions that can reach $250,000 a year. The reputation protection racket is so galling that an Army officer who served two tours in Iraq wrote a now famous article in 2007 that noted, "A private who loses a rifle suffers far greater consequences than a general who loses a war." We should not be surprised. The United States is a society that excels in elite unaccountability. Just look at the number of bank CEOs who faced criminal charges after the 2008 financial collapse, or the number of Sackler family members who were criminally charged after their company Purdue Pharma started the opioid epidemic with OxyContin, or the number of billionaires who avoid paying income taxes, lots of them. And let's not forget the politicians and pundits who goaded America into an illegal invasion of Iraq in 2003 and suffered no consequences. It's not clear who takes their cues from whom, but it is obvious that all of these elites benefit from the con. Military impunity is somewhat unique because it stretches downward too. If an intelligence analyst or drone operator or fighter pilot follows orders and procedures for an airstrike that kills dozens of civilians in a wedding party, which has happened, they need to be excused of wrongdoing. After all, who gave the orders and who set the procedures? These questions would require looking up the chain of command, and for that reason, they're not asked with any intention of finding the answers. That's why it was with no sense of alarm that secret military documents published by The Intercept in 2015 noted that in a two-year campaign called Operation Haymaker, 9 of 10 Afghans killed in U.S. drone strikes were not the intended targets. For the U.S., this was the acceptable cost of doing business. The Pentagon's culture of impunity for killing civilians stands in contrast to its zealous pursuit of troops for other offenses. Unlike the Securities and Exchange Commission, which regulates the financial industry, or IRS, which oversees taxpayers, or the Senate and House Ethics Committees, which keep an eye on members of Congress, the U.S. military has wide authority and deep resources to impose an array of penalties, from pay reductions to loss of rank and death sentences. The military avidly uses these powers too. In 2020 alone, there were more than 37,000 cases of discipline in the armed forces, and since 2001, there have been more than 1.3 million cases. Yet these powers have been used sparingly or not at all when it comes to airstrikes that kill civilians. One of the worst massacres in two decades of warfare occurred not long ago, on March 18, 2019, when U.S. warplanes dropped bombs that killed scores of civilians, mostly women and children, in Syria. As the Times reported last month, an analyst who watched the attack on a drone video typed into a secure chat system. Who dropped that? Another analyst wrote, "We just dropped on 50 women and children. A quick battle assessment settled on 70 people killed. A legal officer flagged it as a possible war crime that warranted an investigation," the Times noted. "But at nearly every step, the military made moves that concealed the catastrophic strike." The Pentagon's Inspector General looked into what happened, but even its report was stalled and stripped of any mention of the strike. An elevator who worked on the Inspector General's report, Jean Tate, was forced out of his job after complaining about the lack of progress and honesty. Tate told the Times, "Leadership just seemed so set on burying this. For instance, there was a 2015 airstrike on a hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan, that killed 42 patients and staffers. The military's reluctant discipline included counseling and retraining for some of the personnel involved." The point is this: a military establishment that has enthusiastically enforced requirements for things as petty as wearing a reflector belt while jogging has consistently failed to discipline troops for wrongful bombings that its own battle assessments knowledge have killed civilians. The machinery of impunity actually has two missions. The most obvious is to excuse people who should not be excused. The other is to punish those who try to expose the machine because it does not function well in daylight. That's why Daniel Hale, an Air Force veteran whom the government accused of leaking those classified drone documents to The Intercept, was sentenced under the Espionage Act to nearly 4 years in prison. It is not the act of killing civilians that will result in definite and heavy punishment, but exposing the act of killing. It seems ridiculous to think that the U.S. military's cover-ups will be undone. The Pentagon is now getting even more support from the country in a form that is easy to measure and crucial to sustaining its clout: funding. Congress has just passed a military budget of $768 billion, which is more than was allocated in 2020, even though U.S. troops withdrew this year in a humiliating fashion from their forever war in Afghanistan. Despite what has happened, America's elected representatives are not loosening their protective embrace of the Pentagon. The U.S. machinery of impunity is not susceptible to pressure from larger nations. But the journalists, whistleblowers, and researchers who have done the hard work of exposing its lies, they are still at work. The more these people uncover, the harder they toil.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Midstream.
As the date of the withdrawal of U.S. combat occupation forces from Iraq approaches supposedly within days now, Iraqis are still skeptical that the U.S. withdrawal from their country will be a real one. Who's to blame them when the first announced official date of the long goodbye was supposedly August 2021, as per the Trump administration? However, the deadline was simply ignored by the new Biden administration. In July, U.S. President Joe Biden and Iraq's Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi met in Washington and allegedly agreed to conclude the American combat mission in Iraq by December 31, 2021. That's 3 days from now. Really? They are just going to simply leave? Well, follow me a little. Let us see how the U.S. operates in Iraq to begin with. It is no secret that the U.S. had adopted a low-cost colonial system of ruling Iraq for almost 10 years now. U.S. warplanes were stationed at up to six former Iraqi air bases, becoming the principal enforcer of the occupation. U.S. troops were thinned out. By 2020, this job was done so skillfully that the U.S. presence in Iraq became almost invisible. Hold on, I said almost. Iraq was occupied by Western forces, but it looked like an independent nation with the U.S. installed president and executive branch. Kurdish areas in the north became virtual U.S.-run mini-states. The demented Daesh movement was totally stamped out by Iraqi Hashd al-Sha'bi and the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps. As a thank you, the Iranian military supremo in Iraq, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps al-Quds forces, was ordered murdered by President Trump. Deputy head of the Iraqi Hashd al-Sha'bi, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, arose a martyr that day alongside his dear friend and comrade, Martyr Hashd Qasem Soleimani. This grave mistake turned the golden victory in Iraq promised by the American neocons into ashes, leaving Washington stuck deep in an ungovernable nation, yet still capable of defeating Daesh and then targeting its real enemy, the U.S. occupation forces scattered in Iraq. Faced by the threat of more resistance guerrilla warfare, Joe Biden's administration announced it would pull all remaining U.S. combat troops from Iraq, but leaving 2,500 behind for training and embassy security. Training is a bad joke. Iraq has been almost in constant war since 1980. Iraqis need loyalty, pride, and patriotism to be effective fighters. How did I know? Here's a hint. Take a look at how Hashd al-Sha'bi operates and you'll realize what the Iraqi army is missing. Who needs training from the armed forces that got whipped in Vietnam and now in Afghanistan? Iraq needs a real national government rather than foreign agents in Baghdad. Which is basically why, my friends, the U.S. will not withdraw from Iraq. It might change the name of its combat forces, but an occupation will always be an occupation, with resistance being its only form of elimination. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. As the date of the withdrawal of U.S. combat forces from Iraq approaches by the end of 2021, Iraqis remain skeptical about whether the withdrawal is real or just on paper. In July, the United States and Iraq held a strategic dialogue session during which the two countries agreed on withdrawing all U.S. combat troops from Iraq by December 31st of this year. Now, Tahsin al-Khafaji, spokesman of the Iraqi Joint Operations Command, had announced last month that most of the combat forces left Iraq and only advisors and those working in the field of intelligence, investigation, and training remained, reiterating that they will leave within 15 days. However, Iraqis fear that there might be no real withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq, neither now after the 15 days have actually passed, nor in the upcoming new year. Rather, as many of the observers believe, there will be only a change in the name of these forces. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Al-Basra in Iraq is Mr. Ali Al-Madhoush, expert in international relations and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Al-Madhoush. It's a pleasure having you on our show. Now, it seems that the question of the century is, will the U.S. really pull out of its of Iraq with its occupation forces by the end of this year, or will it just hang in there and stay? They might chill. They have nothing to lose.
Ya Allah, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful. Thank you for hosting me on your show. Of course, as it's well known, especially to those who deal with American approach and behavior, they know that the Americans have great ambitions and intentions announced openly concerning their interests here in Iraq and the region. All this eruption and all this fallout and fragmentation and this great weakness and instability in the region is because none other than the U.S. America has reneged on covenants it had ratified with its own hands. Anyone with just little insight knows very well that if America comes out a door, it re-enters through a wider one and changes colors like a chameleon using painful methods. Undoubtedly, the U.S. cannot leave this region as it views it as spoils of war par excellence.
Well, Ms. Ali, according to the agreement between Baghdad and Washington, the American forces will keep personnel for, and I quote here, consulting, training, equipment, or equipping, and exchanging intelligence information, I don't know with whom, but that's what they're saying. Now, who's to say that the U.S. won't keep all of its forces, but simply just change their name on paper or maybe move the combat forces to Syria at a close range from Iraq at all times.
I totally agree with you. It was agreed and approved by Iraqi law and voted on by the Iraqi parliament that no foreign military presence will be allowed in Iraq after December 31, 2021, which is the last legal day for the U.S. presence inside Iraq. However, we know there is a lot of maneuvering and a lot of getting around this decision. In fact, I tell you that there are those inside Iraq who do not want America to leave, unfortunately. The order of the occupation forces to remain is not dependent on America as much as it's dependent on the interests of the certain Iraqi employers of foreign forces. It's humiliating, to be honest with you, how hard they fight to make sure the Americans remain here, crouching on the chest of the Iraqis and the region. There are many measures that America has put in place regarding the neighboring periphery, such as the border with Al-Bukamal and the border with the western region of Iraq. There is also the U.S. Embassy, which contains the largest military base in which America uses advanced defense equipment to protect, as if it wants to stay forever. We agree with you that there is a maneuver that America has prepared for. We are sure that the U.S. forces' exit will only happen on paper, but the truth remains and they cannot change it.
Masadi, Iraqi political groups have called the formation of an alliance to expel American troops from the Arab country, from Iraq, when their mandate finishes by the end of this year, stating that Washington's attempts to prolong the presence of its occupation forces must never be taken into consideration. Do you think that is actually a viable option in case Washington proves to be actually dodging the withdrawal date? Do you think that fighting it out is the option?
It's well known that the Iraqi resistance factions, represented today by the popular mobilization forces, have become deterrent forces against the American entity and the usurping Israeli entity. This resistance has formed an equation of balance of forces. It's the resistance alliance that hurt the Americans and has become a striking tool for restoring rights and limiting the role of the Americans in the region. Today, the Iraqi government and its institutions and the Iraqi regular army undoubtedly have many U.S.-imposed restrictions and many strict measures as they cannot proceed with the process of extracting the Iraqi right. We have harnessed a great experience in fighting the American forces after the U.S. invasion. The U.S. occupation has suffered many hard blows by the Iraqi resistance factions. Undoubtedly, America is determined and waiting for the moment when law, Sharia, custom and humanity justify for us to expel the occupier from our country, especially against an occupation that breaks all laws. So basically, after December 31, Iraq turns into an occupied country, and all occupied countries have the full right to defend their lands and stand in the face of the invaders. May God give more strength to the Iraqi resistance factions. It always does what it vows to do. The U.S. occupation is always on high alert because of the severity of the resistance valor. The awareness of its leaders and its bases that have experienced war for years now, fighting and eliminating Daesh is an example.
Well, Masali, we know by heart by now how the U.S. operates when it desires to change reality on the ground, especially in Iraq. We might witness a sharp escalation of chaos, of tensions within the coming weeks as part of efforts to drive U.S. Forces to stay further inside of the country under the pretext of maintaining security inside of Iraq. How do you think the Iraqi resistance forces will react to such a possible scenario?
It is no secret for everyone who follows the American dirty politics that it plays bad roles in its cultural war, its media war, its soft war, its policy of containment, its policy of interfering in internal affairs and imposing its influence by different means and under many pretexts. Today, many countries fall for American lies, such as Saudi Arabia and others, who are deluded into the existence of the illusion of an enemy represented by the Islamic Republic of Iran in order to create an excuse to sell weapons and maintain their forces and interests in West Asia. Therefore, America will create many crises inside Iraq. But the conscious, the knowledgeable, the people of politics, and those who are aware are following and monitoring this phenomenon. Today, we see that the signs of Americans' embrace of some factions and its sponsorship of some parties have begun to create an unstable and abnormal situation that will place Iraq on a hot plate. Signs of these movements started from the American support for some factions and forces in order to provoke instability that will lead all Iraqi blocs to turn to other external forces to take care of Iraq and get it out of this predicament. Today, the political tensions is evident under the auspices of America and its great intervention by changing the rules of the game. But the resistance forces and factions are conscious and want to miss the U.S. opportunity to invade. Today in Iraq, both wisdom and strength are present to confront America using its own tools.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ali Al-Madhoush, expert in international relations and political commentator, for joining us from Al-Basra, Iraq. It's a pleasure to have you on our show. And please now stay tuned, because next we will be talking about what options does the Iraqi resistance have to try and push the occupation out of Iraq.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Prior to Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi's visit to the United States, the New York Times described the new agreement to withdraw U.S. forces from Iraq as nothing but a diplomatic play, while Sabrin News, channel affiliated with the Popular Mobilization Forces, criticized the agreement, saying that no American soldier will be withdrawn, their role will only be changed on paper. Why is this agreement seen as a theatrical show? Well, a number of pro-U.S. Iraqi leaders do not want to see the United States completely withdrawing from Iraq. These officials propagate that the U.S. actually supports a stable and friendly Iraq, while asserting every chance they get that a long-term U.S. presence, although maintains American influence in Iraq, however, it will help them mitigate Iranian, Russian, and other forms of what the U.S. refers to as malign influence. Funny how other states that enjoy normal diplomatic non-military ties with Iraq are viewed as malign by the U.S., while its own forces of occupation is praised as friendship. On second thought, no, it's not funny, it's actually sick. Will the U.S. ever leave Iraq? More in this following report.
Ever since the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, it was required of the U.S. occupation to exploit Iraq within a strategy that affects the entire region. However, in recent months, the so-called strategic dialogue between Baghdad and Washington, which set a time frame for the withdrawal of American forces and whose sessions took place under the threats and strikes of the Iraqi resistance led by factions of the Hashd al-Shaabi, gave many indications of how Iraq has turned from an imminent American threat against the axis of resistance in the early post-invasion stages to a threat against the presence of American occupation forces as part of this same axis. And if Iraq's positioning in the U.S. strategy was mainly related to striking the centers of power supporting the resistance movements between Lebanon and occupied Palestine, that is Syria and Iran, while making Iraq the center of an active American presence in the region, then the reality that American policy has reached does not only indicate a failure in that particular goal, but rather exceeds it to with a failure within Iraq itself. It was not required to isolate Iraq during the invasion stage from the ongoing state of conflict with the Israeli occupation entity, because it was already outside that conflict. Rather, what was required of Iraq was to be used to isolate and neutralize Syria and Iran, and then attack later on the resistance factions. However, in the years following the invasion, Washington's calculations collided with the transformations witnessed in the Iraqi arena. Iraq itself turned into a popular military and security offshoot for different resistance factions in West Asia and indeed has become among its deterrent force. In recent months, Iraqi resistance factions affiliated with the popular mobilization Hashd al-Shaabi announced that they had entered the deterrence equation regarding al-Quds, which was announced by Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, considering that violating al-Quds equals a regional war. This particular part expresses the transformation inside Iraq, which the United States has always been trying to prevent. This was clearly demonstrated in the report of the Israeli National Security Institute at the end of last year, considering that the Zionist front in any upcoming war will be attacked with thousands of missiles, including dozens of precision missiles and armed drones from several arenas in parallel, from Lebanon, Syria, Western Iraq, and probably Gaza as well. The American military and political presence in Iraq is now threatened by the Hashd al-Shaabi forces, and things could spiral towards a military escalation if the United States tries to circumvent the promises of its withdrawal, at a time when the latter seems unable to enter into an open war. This development was never by chance. Washington was seeking to place Iraq on the map of confronting Syria and Iran, but the resistance axis was aware of the danger of the American scheme leading the axis to embrace Iraqi resistance forces in the post-occupation stage. This kept the American tactic trapped inside the Iraqi arena and transferred it from a strategy of dismantling Syria and Iran outside Iraq to a practical path of dismantling its own military occupation bases inside of it due to the threats of the Iraqi Hashd al-Shaabi.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Stockholm is Mr. Firas Ali, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Firas. Now, the top U.S. commander of the Middle East, his name is General Kenneth Frank McKenzie, he said last week that the United States will keep the current 2,500 troops inside of Iraq for what he said is the foreseeable future. So they're not leaving after all. So why all this propaganda of them leaving when they're not?
Well, I think it's business as usual for the Americans. They're trying to confuse the Iraqi people by conveying different type of information in this regard. Sometimes they say they're going to leave. Sometimes they say, we have to make a deal first. And mostly they say, we're not going to leave. We're changing the status, the title of the troops in Iraq, from combating troops to advisors. But regardless of what they call them, they're only playing with words and counting on time. But no one in Iraq is interested, and especially not the resistance, to play any word feud games with them. They're going to stay. What I think is that the Americans don't have the intention to leave Iraq. They have to be forced out of Iraq, because they have invested a lot of money in Iraq, and they've invested and built the biggest embassy in the world in Baghdad, second to the one that is going to come up in Beirut. And they have a military camp in the embassy, the Union 3 camp. So there's a reason for them to resist being forced out from Iraq. But I think this method that they're using by wasting time, counting on time, and trying to confuse people won't work, because they think that people will forget the occupation and go on. But it won't work, because the Iraqi people, especially after the assassination in January last year, have changed, and the tide has changed against the United States of America.
Well, Firas, basically, despite the so-called shift by U.S. forces to a non-combat role in Iraq, they said clearly that they will still provide air support and other military aid for Iraq's fight against Daesh terrorist groups. Now, hold on a second there, because the entire globe already knows who bred, funded, and trained Daesh in Iraq and Syria. And for the love of God, I mean, America killed the two most prominent commanders in West Asia who actually fought and eliminated Daesh. And I'm talking about Martyr Soleimani and Martyr Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. How come the Iraqi population is just okay with this? They continue with their lives when they are being played by the United States of America.
I don't think generally people in Iraq are okay with this. The Iraqi people has a lot of grievances, of course, and the Americans are making them bigger to just to adjust the time so they can still go on and be have a presence in Iraq. But the title that they're giving to their forces, advisor, that's only a title. The Americans has already acted in Iraq since they came back in 2014 as landlords, and they will continue to do so as long as they are in Iraq. They have not heeded to the agreement they had with the Iraqi government since 2014, and they've acted like they've controlled the Iraqi airspace totally, and they've dealt with the Iraqi resistance forces and Hashd al-Shaabi, which is basically part of the Defense Department in Iraq, as terrorists sometimes. And you have the unexpected visit of Trump to Ayn al-Assad, which the Iraqi government didn't know of, and actually in the assassination of the commander of the leaders of the victory leaders, as you mentioned, the Americans used more drones in Iraqi airspace in that operation than what they are allowed to in their deal with the Iraqi government. So no Iraqi accept their presence in Iraq if they don't have any personal benefit. But I would say most Iraqis despises the Americans, because they remember that most of their problems from the ascending of the Ba'ath Party was because of U.S. interference in Iraq. They have not forgotten that the United States of America imposed two wars on Iraq. They forced the Iraqi government in eight years war with Iran, and they put sanctions on the Iraqi people that killed more than half a million Iraqi children. The Secretary of State in the United States at that time, Albright, said that this is a price worth to pay, and the Iraqis remember this. And actually, it was the Iraqi people's representatives in the parliament who voted to expel the U.S. troops. So the political situation in Iraq is a mess sometimes, but this vote in the parliament is historic because it shows how big the disapprovement of the U.S. forces in Iraq are.
So basically, the U.S. will try to delay its withdrawal, just as you said, to suggest that it actually has the upper hand in where it goes with its troops, and instead of actually being compelled to be kicked out of Iraq and withdraw. But the Iraqi resistance seemingly has a very different plan for the U.S. occupation forces. How do you see the upcoming year in Iraq, knowing that the U.S. has never stood by its declarations and agreements when it comes to any area that it